This song is addressed to my sisters. Any man who is present may listen. Any priest, any public official, any physician. But it gives him no license to touch us. We make the decision.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Judith Arcana, author of the new book of stories, Hello, This is Jane, published by Oregon's Left Fork Press. Judith writes poems, stories, essays, and books. Her work includes a biography of Grace Paley titled Grace Paley's Life Stories, the poetry collections What If Your Mother, Fourth Period English, The Parachute, Jump Effect, and Here from Somewhere Else, which won the 2015 Turtle Island Quarterly Editor's Choice Chapbook Award. Her story, soon to be a major motion picture, which is included in the new collection, won the first Minerva Rising Prose Prize and was published as a chapbook. A longtime teacher of literature, writing, and women's studies, Judith also volunteered as a Jane, a member of the Chicago Underground Service that helped more than 11,000 women get safe, illegal abortions before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Roe v. Wade in January 1973. KBOO listeners might know Judith from her monthly poetry show, Poetry and Everything, which aired from 2013 to just recently, January 2020. Here's Lainey Zumas on Hello, This is Jane. Quote, I'm profoundly grateful to Judith Arcana for writing these vital, electrifying stories, with abortion rights in America being stripped away state by state, clinic by clinic. We need to hear from those who fought this battle before. Arcana is a Jane. Her work in the pre-Roe abortion underground has provided the seeds for her fiction, stories rooted in essential history to spark action in our terrifying present. Judith Arcana, thanks for zooming in today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Judith, in the intro, we mentioned your work as a Jane in Chicago in the years just before the Supreme Court ruled on Roe v. Wade. So that was January 1973. It's such an important part of Hello, This is Jane. Could you give us a little background on the Janes, which was officially called, and this is a long name, the Abortion Counseling Service of the Chicago Women's Liberation Union, or just the service for short?
Well, of course, I'll give you the briefest of briefs. In the mid to late 60s, a particular woman, Heather Booth, one of the people whose name is already known, had occasion to help a friend find a local, which is to say in Chicago, abortionist for his sister who was in a terrible shape and needed abortion health care. And she did that. And then, of course, as such things do happen, people heard that Heather knew how to find somebody. And then other people started calling her, asking her for information. And she finally had a meeting of women from the union that you just named in that long name.
Yes, the service.
Well, what became the service. Uh-huh. And she said to the other women, look, this is clearly something that needs to be done. And they said, absolutely. And they started up first as a referral service, then over time started learning medical procedures themselves. And by the time the service was over, it had become completely independent of asking other folks for their services and was able, therefore, to lower the price to $100 or whatever you could afford. I remember very clearly one woman that I was the counselor for who had $9. And I thought over the years, what would have become of her if she had tried to go to a regular doctor, even one who was willing to do abortions when they were illegal? They charged $1,000 or more. So yeah, that's a very brief capsule version.
Oh, of course, we'll get more into it as we go along. I want to go back to that 1968 when the Janes were starting. You were teaching high school in Chicago, and it was at the very same school you attended as a student. And you loved
it. Actually, a little north of Chicago. I have to I was in a township north of Chicago, not in the city.
Oh, okay. And you loved your job.
I certainly did.
But you were fired, I think, primarily for political reasons. But yes. Since you had tenure as a high school teacher and presumably the support of the union, what was the case for termination and what were those real reasons?
Well, it turns out, or in those days, I don't know if the laws are the same in Illinois, but at that time, the law was that if a tenured teacher was fired, that teacher had the right to a public hearing. And three of us were fired, two of whom were tenured. So the other tenured teacher and I insisted on our public hearing, which turned out to, we thought it would be an hour or two. It took months, when a period of months from May of 1970 down to October of 1970, two or three nights a week in the high school auditorium, sitting hundreds of people came to the auditorium, most of them students and students' parents, and the school board listened to what was essentially a court case. They had a lawyer, we had a lawyer, we called witnesses, they called witnesses, and you will not be shocked to learn that at the end of this entire quote-unquote hearing, which was obviously a trial, the school board, which had the power under the law to be the judges, decided that they had been right to fire us. And so that was that. That was the end. I was a high school teacher for 6 years, loving it all the while.
And then again, to set the scene, so you were fired from a job that you loved. We should also mention this is happening in the context of Chicago in the late 60s and the entire nation, for that matter, with the protests against the Vietnam War, the election of Richard Nixon as president, the police murders of Black Panthers, Fred Hampton, Matt Clark. So that must have been a galvanizing moment for you personally and politically.
Definitely so. I always say that is an example of how often it is that the teacher is learning just as much as, if not more than, the students in a teacher-student relationship. They came into the classroom. I'm not saying everybody did this, but great numbers of them responding to the very circumstances that you just named one after another came into the classroom and said, can we read this? Let's talk about this. How about this? And I thought, you know, it took me a while to get with the program, so to speak, even though the school board thought I and my colleagues, we were the instigators, because they had no respect, really, for the minds of those young people. It never occurred to them that those young people were thinking what they were thinking on their own, based on what was happening in the country and the world, as you just gave in that list. So they blamed it on the grown-ups, so to speak, which is so often the case. Teachers are being fired all over the country. And my knowledge base was growing exponentially. My consciousness was rising like a thermometer in a fever. And it was the beginning for me of serious and what became deeply rooted political consciousness, those years and the being fired. And then, of course, joining an underground abortion service,
right,
that too ramped up my consciousness considerably.
That's what I was leading up to. But first, I'm thinking nationwide protests, terrible president in the White House, police murdering African Americans. That was
sounds familiar. Right?
Yes, way too familiar. Yes. Now, when you joined the Janes, abortion was illegal in most of the U.S., with a few exceptions. New York, it was legalized in 1970. I just read that in Oregon, it actually became legal in 1969. So it's really difficult for younger people today to imagine what it was like for a woman wanting an abortion at that time. But it was mostly done undercover, not always under the safest, most sanitary conditions. And as you mentioned before, it could be very expensive, $1,000, which was a whole lot more in 1970. What was the situation like in Chicago?
Well, pretty much what you've described. I mean, Illinois was not one of the handful of states that had abortion as a legal healthcare procedure. And so both actual degreed medical practitioners, docs, could do abortions undercover, underground. They often charged a lot of money. Not very many of them did it, of course. And also people who did not have the best interests of the women who came to them at heart or in their minds, who also charged a lot of money and didn't necessarily do a good job. So that was pretty common in Illinois, certainly in the Chicago area. It was common everywhere. And as you noted, Ken, there were a few places. Women with money could travel to New York or to England or to Japan or to Puerto Rico, some places that folks with money could go in those days where abortion was legal. But how many people is that? You know, it's always true for the rich. They can do whatever they want because they can buy it.
Right. Now, yeah. As a Jane, Judith, you went from putting women in touch with doctors, so mainly a counseling service, to actually performing the abortions. And I've heard you talk about that story, how one of the doctors the Janes recruited to do the abortions, the Janes found out he wasn't really a medical doctor, but he was still able to do it. But that gave you, as a group, the inspiration to say, well, why can't we do it? So how did you go about doing that? What was your training to do some of these medical procedures?
Well, first of all, he was, this particular guy who wasn't really a doctor was absolutely the best. He was very, very good. And he treated the women in goodly ways. And he was approving of what we were doing and friendly to the enterprise, shall we say. And some of us became friends with him. I was not one of those people, although I was sort of an adjunct buddy. Sometimes on non-work days, some of us would hang out, and that's how I got to know him, as well as when we finally leaned on him enough to start teaching us stuff. At first he said, no. And we just kept it up. And because he was, as I say, you know, basically decent and totally connected ultimately with us. Plus we were a tremendous source of income for him, you know. He didn't even have to do what he used to do in the old days. We just said, come on, we've hundreds of women are calling us every week. We'll book this, you know. Anyway, he came over to that notion of, well, if he can do it, we can do it. And he taught a couple of us, and those people taught others of us. And he did a little teaching as well. And then pretty soon, he happily was phased out. The mob was after him. The cops were after him. He moved out of state. And by then, he had trained enough of us, and those people had trained enough of us, so that we knew how to perform what in those days was the typical abortion, which was a DNC, dilatation and curettage. And for what we called long terms, people farther along in the pregnancy, procuring a miscarriage, which then would have to take place separately. But anyway, we learned how to do it just as he had learned how to do it underground, but from someone who really, really knew what to do.
Now, I could see why the cops were after him if he was performing illegal abortions, but what's his connection with the mob?
Well, he had no connection with the mob, but the mob, of course, anything that's illegal, they want to cut. It could be gambling. It could be drugs. When abortion is illegal, it's abortion, all kinds of stuff. And they had their own team of abortionists, but if they heard of someone else, they would, you know, just like in the movie. So, you know, and he was not into it. So he was.
Wow. I never heard about that the mob was involved.
Yeah.
But it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. He would not play their game. And of course, they were not the least bit interested in us. We were literally a penny ante operation. You know, $100 or whatever you can afford. See you later. You know, I mean, they never bothered us.
You weren't cutting into their profits, or
No. They didn't even consider us financially. Let's put it that way. We were not existent.
Now, you and several other Janes were labeled the Abortion Seven, I guess because Chicago Seven was already taken. When you were arrested in Chicago, May 3rd, 1972 is the date. So it was just 8 months or so before Roe v. Wade. Can you tell us about the arrest and the charges? And the arrest is actually fictionalized in several of the stories in the new collection. And I got to say, I saw your mugshot, which is on the cover of one of the zines, the chapbooks, and you look so badass.
Do I really? Oh, wow. I never thought of it that way. The publisher of that zine, that was his idea. He said, we're going to put the mugshot on the cover. I said, are you serious? I mean, I thought, really? What's that about? Well, turns out he absolutely knew what he was doing. People are totally into that mugshot. Fine with me. And the reason that I have it is that one of the things we did after Roe was decided in January, at the end of January of 73, was that we wanted all of our records because we were no longer criminals once Roe was decided. And so I have the paperwork and I have the mugshot, and, you know, and the other six do too. Anyway, so there were seven of us working that day, hence the title, The Abortion Seven. And, you know, it's scary to be arrested. We always knew that it could happen sometime. We didn't think about it much. We were pretty busy, and we certainly knew it was illegal. But, you know, law is not the same thing as justice. They are two different things. And not just in this country, but everywhere in the world, many things that are the law are completely unjust. For openers, this country is, you know, as an economic entity, it was, of course, completely based on enslavement, the enslavement of people. That was the law. So law in and of itself was not a concern. Behaving in goodly ways, being of use, those were the concerns of not only the seven, but the women who joined the service and stayed with it, whether they were doing medical work or counseling or there's certain business, you know, answering the phone. In those days, all the equipment we have now did not exist. I had never seen an answering machine before I joined the service. I don't even know if I knew there were such things. And there were maybe like six of them. I don't know. And the answering machine that the service had was as big as the stove in my kitchen right now. You know, it was just so, it was primeval. But one of my very, in fact, literally my first job within 1 week of joining the service in the fall of 1970 was to take the messages. So I had to learn how to use this machine, take the messages off the machine, keep records for all the women who had called, and then go to meetings. And the counselors would take this. We used index cards, of course, writing all the information there. So have I answered that question? Or should I go?
No, you did. I just wanted to add that as a result of the arrest, you were actually indicted by a grand jury, or the Abortion Seven, so all the Janes who were arrested. And again, the difference between law and justice. The law said the charges were felony homicide.
Exactly.
And conspiracy to commit abortion, because it was illegal at the time, which meant, you know, homicide, conspiracy, that could have meant years in jail for you. But in January 1973, so a few months later, the Supreme Court came down with the Roe v. Wade decision. Yes. So for several reasons, then you must have been extremely relieved and overjoyed.
We all were enormously relieved, of course. And for me personally, one of the reasons was that I had a little baby on purpose at that time. And so my first thought, literally, even on the day of the bust, was, they're going to take my baby away from me because they're, you know, they're these charges. So that was pretty grim. I kept expecting to see within 48 hours of the bust, the headline, nursing mother arrested for abortion, but nobody was smart enough to use it. So I put it in the book. I just thought, are you kidding? I can't believe you people don't, you know, anyway.
And you were actually, not nursing in the mugshot, but you were lactating. You were still breastfeeding your child. Yeah.
Yes.
At that point, of course, you turned your attention to writing and studying literature. But I keep wondering, did you ever consider a career in the medical profession, given all the training you had, maybe studying to be an OBGYN?
Actually, I did consider, not to go to medical school, but to become a midwife. For a year or two after the time in the after the service shut down, which was in, I think you said, in April of 73, I thought about that because I had loved the work so much. It was so obviously useful. It was such obviously good work. And I loved doing it. But finally, you know, it was like a wake-up call. I said, get a grip. You're in the English department. You know, you are a word woman. And I mean, I didn't say those exact words to myself, but as I look back, I realize that that was what finally got into my head. Now, it is still true that in the first couple years after the service shut down, between the Roe decision and the Hyde Amendment in 76, when things were looking like they would be pretty healthy and that there would be justice, several of the women, either, well, Janes and not Janes, joined the Chicago Women's Liberation Union's Liberation School, and we did a lot of teaching. So I taught a lot about women and their bodies, about menstruation, about pregnancy, nursing, childbirth, abortion, contraception, and I loved doing that. That was part of what made me think, oh, maybe I'll be a midwife, and I was moving down that road a little until I finally said, please, that's not who you are. So that was extremely satisfying in the same way, because I knew that what we were doing, those of us who were teaching those courses, visiting schools, my favorite example, Mother Guerin, a Catholic high school on the west side of Chicago, they invited me and possibly another person, I'm not sure, 50 years ago, what can I say? We were invited to come to speak at this Catholic high school. And there I was up at the front of the room with the nun who was the teacher, who was so terrific. And the two of us were taking questions and answers from this all-girl classroom about women's bodies, menstruation, contraception, et cetera. It was amazing. So I had a lot of big-time learning. And actually, I'm going to use this word, joy, from the work that came from that learning.
Which is a good transition to the book itself. Hello, this is Jane. Before we did that, Judith, I just wanted to fill in. I had to look it up. You'd figure I would know better. But the Hyde Amendment was actually a backlash against the Roe v. Wade decision.
Yes.
It was a legislature, so U.S. Congress passed it about 3 years later, 1976. And it forbid federal funds going to pay for abortions, with some rare exceptions. And those exceptions were later expanded, I think, under Clinton. But it was kind of an anti-abortion legislation.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So part of that backlash, and we'll get into that a little later, as some of the stories mention it. But the book is based, of course, on your experiences, Jane, and you've written some email letters to help promote the book during the quarantine, during the pandemic. You say that you didn't start bringing this experience into your own work, at least consciously and deliberately, until 1998. And I was wondering, what was the spark? You know, your early writings, you was poetry. You wrote that great book on Grace Paley, a literary biography of Grace Paley. So what was that? What happened in 1998?
You know, that's a really good question. And unfortunately, I don't have a really good answer. But the answer that I have is I remember the moment. I don't know what made the moment happen. But it's just so classic in terms of symbolism, maybe metaphor. I don't know. But anyway, here's what it was. I was in the kitchen of my home, and I was breaking eggs into a bowl. And all of a sudden, I had this, it sort of, you know, it sounds kind of creepy, but it was totally positive. I had this bodily sensation, and I dropped the egg thing, wiped my hands on the dish towel, grabbed the closest pen and paper. I always see to it wherever I live, pens and pencils and paper everywhere. Even now, when we all live online, I do that as well as the computer, and started writing and created what became the first poem that would be in the book, What If Your Mother, which came out in 2005, which is poems and monologues that are rooted in my learning in those years. And that poem begins with eggs. And the idea, you know, yeah, chickens make a man, so do we. And what is that? What does that mean? And the experience of breaking the eggs deliberately. So that's the beginning. Why that happened at that time on that day, haven't got a clue. But as you just heard, I remember the moment.
Of course, yeah. That answers the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yes.
In this case, it was the egg.
Absolutely.
Now, we mentioned Grace Paley, who was also a friend of yours and a mentor and a subject of that wonderful literary biography, Grace Paley's Life
Thank
Stories.
You for the good words about the book. Yeah.
And the epigraph for Hello, This is Jane comes from Grace. It goes, quote, fiction, nonfiction, they're made up categories, helpful for librarians and bookstores, but it's all story, really. It's all story. And in one of the stories in the book, soon to be a major motion picture, which we talked about, you write, quote, this is what Grace Paley meant when she said a story is a lie the writer tells in order to tell the truth. Which brings me to the question, why did you write about your Jane experience initially as poems, you know, that egg incident in 1998, then as fiction rather than as nonfiction or a memoir?
Well, you know, again, the question why anything is always delving into the mystery. So I don't know, you know, for sure what the answer is. But I, you know, I could just be petulant and say I didn't want to. But I did write, I remember 10 years after the Roe decision, I did an op-ed for one of the Chicago newspapers. Please don't ask me which one. But anyway, and after that, I wrote essays. And there are essays of mine online and in, you know, newspapers or whatever over the years. So I did write nonfiction prose, either about the service or based on what I learned in the service, here and there, now and then. But the poems just came on, just this heavy vibe, like from, you know, starting with that moment in the kitchen. And then the stories, I think, happened not quite so dramatically, but in similar ways, in that characters came into my head. I didn't want to take, you know, sort of like being a vampire, I guess, to steal someone else's life story. I know that some writers don't mind doing that, but I'm not so much into it. So I preferred the idea of knowing what, in fact, there is a book that is nonfiction based on interviews, and there is a play based on interviews. Both of them have been around for years now and doing good work in the world about the abortion service. And I wanted to not have to do, as I did in my first three books, when I interviewed lots and lots of people, to have to be true to someone else. I wanted to just make it up because I already had all this information. And what I did was, I never again, until literally this year, looked at that nonfiction book or the text of that play. It's been decades, you know, it's been a couple of decades at least since I looked at those because I wanted to just spin it out. And that's what I did.
Yes, I want to go into two stories. One we already mentioned, soon to be a major motion picture, to give examples from the book itself. And that was originally published as a chapbook, and it's told by a fictional character, one of the Janes named Dina Marcus, who seems somewhat of an alter ego for the author. And Dina is telling the story from a future time when, as you write, quote, everybody finally recognized that Roe was now irrelevant, eviscerated. So there's a speculative aspect to the story. Fortunately, still speculative. We don't know what's going to be happening. And Dina is talking to some movie producers about pitching the Bust of the Janes, brainstorming it as a movie. What appealed to you about recounting that event as fiction? Were those fictional elements of making it into a movie at a time when abortion was no longer easily or legally available?
Well, I actually, in your question, you have the answer. I wanted people to know that this could be done, that it was done, and that, yes, we got arrested, and you need to know about that. There's no pretense here that it's all happy-go-lucky, but this is a story that is useful to people who want to take action now. And of course, as we speak right now, there are people who are doing abortions in the parts of the many, many parts of the United States in the year 2020, where abortion is, if not straight up illegal, almost impossible or literally impossible to find. And so I like the idea of on the big screen or even on some of the smaller screens now, having movies about the service in general and then specifically about the Bust, hence that story, so that folks can think about that in detail, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, it brings up, and this is something I didn't know, and I've read a lot of your work and talked to you a lot. You actually helped with a indie movie. It was a feature, so it was fictional, called Ask a Jane. I think Ask for Jane. It came out about 2 years ago. You were considered a consulting producer on it, but you also had a small part.
Well, so small. I mean, most people say, yeah, if you blink, you'll miss me. But in this case, that's actually true.
I actually watched I haven't seen the movie, but I watched the trailer through the website IMDb, and you're in that trailer. So
I am in the trailer.
It was a real surprise, but there's a case where the same event, the Abortion 7, the arrest was fictionalized in this movie. I didn't do enough research to tell listeners and readers where to find out more about the movie, but I guess they can Google that just as easily as I can.
I was just going to say, they have a website. Just go on, you know, take a look at one of your search engines, type in Ask for Jane movie, and you will find lots of stuff that will tell you about how you can get it or where you can see it, et cetera. Yeah.
So there's a case where this fictional story actually became somewhat of a reality, I guess, a few years after you wrote it.
Absolutely. And I enjoyed working with those people very much. It was one of those things that I care a lot about in this time anyway. I mean, these happen to be very congenial, actually excellent humans. But even if we hadn't clicked in that way, I love the idea of people who are generations younger than me, who care about this stuff, wanting to talk to the elders who were there then, you know, and what they have to teach me and what I have that's maybe of use to them. It's a grand exchange. I love doing it.
Which is actually a nice, smooth transition to my next question, which is about a story that is about exactly that. It's called Keisha and Joni and Jane. It was originally published as a zine. It takes place, again, in Portland, Oregon, but in a kind of fictional Portland, Oregon in the near future. Abortion is illegal here in the story.
In the story.
And the story's written in the form of a group meeting between several of the original Janes, so the older women from the 1970s in Chicago, and a group of women in Portland, somewhat contemporary or near future Portland, who are the new Janes. And it gives you a chance to make the new Janes much more diverse in terms of ethnic, cultural background, and sexual orientation. So I was wondering, was that done on purpose so you could kind of reimagine Janes from your day to what they would be like as your contemporaries today?
I didn't think of it I like that line about the reimagining. I can't take credit for actually having thought of that, but I definitely was along those lines in my own imaginings. I live in the present, even though the story is futured, that of course any group, and of course it's happening right now while we're talking, or folks, while you're listening to this broadcast, people of various colors and sizes and sexual identities and genderedness, et cetera, are going to be the ones who are making stuff happen. Now, we were a pale lot until the very end in the last 6 or 8 months, I think, of the service's existence. There was one African-American woman and one Latina who did some time as Janes. So, yeah, great differences in that regard. And there was not one out lesbian. I mean, it's so ridiculous when you think about it now. It's like crazy. How could that have been? But really, you know, as a lot of my characters say, it was different then. And I don't think that the lesbianic Janes were afraid that the other Janes would shun them or anything. It was what you did in those days. People were not out until, as I like to think, 10 minutes later, when suddenly, boom, you know, Stonewall, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, now, unfortunately, it's back to being dangerous. There's been several cases, even in Portland, of never really stopped, right.
But yes, great strides have been made, and they're not, that striding is not going to stop.
Yeah, one thing in the story, when the women are discussing kind of the differences between Chicago in the early 70s and Portland and contemporary Portland and the near future, one thing I didn't realize is that the anti-choice movement has come up with relatively new ways to demonize abortion. You have one of the original Janes, I'm quoting from the story, say, How about the abortion is murder thing? I never heard anybody say abortion is murder in the 60s and 70s, certainly not before the Hyde Amendment, which we talked about. And what was that, 76? That all came with the anti's focus on the fetus. Before then, we virtually never talked about fetuses the way so many people do now as babies. So that was something that I didn't realize. It was a religious thing. It was also, it meant that the woman was more sexually liberated than she should have been, according to those times. But now, yeah, the fetus and the whole anti-choice movement is basically about murder. And yeah. These are the very same people who don't care about grown-ups getting killed.
Oh, you know,
I'm assuming there a lot of them are the ones not wearing masks in public because it's against their freedom.
I think
and their
there
liberty.
May be some crossover there. I think you're onto something. Yes.
Yeah. So that was really interesting. That's something we face today, which there was enough to demonize it then, and certainly it was against the law, so it was illegal.
Oh, definitely. I remember when I was in high school when everybody knew. Certainly everybody who was in any way heterosexually inclined, whether you were just making out or what was called petting in those days, or actually going all the way, the main thing that you had to pay attention to for girls was not to get pregnant. However, or at the same time, if you did get pregnant, now, I'm not speaking for everyone, and there were certainly very religious people or people under the control of their parents in really fierce ways, but a lot of us, then we would think, oh, well, then I'll have to have an abortion. Now, of course, we were ignorant 15-year-olds, so we had no idea how to go about that. But just a decade or so later, when some of that period's ignorant 15-year-olds were sitting in my living room and I was being their counselor, I thought, yeah, I really understand this. So the notions that the anti-abortion movement the notions, the ways of thinking and feeling, the emotional responses to abortion, doing it or even thinking about it or contemplating someone else doing it, all of that, they made that up. There were certainly people who were not in favor of abortion or thought it was wrong, but it was such a tiny percentage and it was such a tiny presence that you really hardly knew it existed in those years. And definitely the Hyde Amendment was the kickoff for that big movement's. And they did. They're not stupid, those people. They wouldn't be winning if they were stupid. They not only fetishized the fetus for a good 10 or 15, maybe even as many as 20 years, and then they finally realized they had to start paying attention to women. And so then they changed their routines and changed their procedures. They kept the murder thing, but then they added women's welfare and mumsiness, et cetera. Yeah, they're pretty tough. They've been winning.
Well, the Republicans have pretty much aligned themselves with the anti-choice movement. So that's one way of getting the votes.
I think of this occasionally. Donald Trump. How many women have had abortions because of Donald Trump, really? Whether he raped them or forced them into a difficult situation or was their employer, whatever. Just a guess. What an outrageous. I mean, of course, he's. God, I'm sorry I brought him up. Let's get him out of this show. Sorry.
But that's true. I mean, that kind of support for a man of so low moral character. And
yes, or no moral character.
No moral character. Yes, I was giving him too much credit there.
Really? Yes.
Now, the book itself is a collection of link stories, linked because of characters, events, themes that occur throughout. Was that a conscious decision when you were writing the stories, or did you notice kind of a pattern when you look back on the stories and you were thinking of collecting them?
Certainly closer to the latter, Ken. I had no, and when I began writing them, just like with the same thing happened with the poems, I didn't think I'm making a book. I was writing a bunch of poems and monologues, and then later I was writing a bunch of stories. And as I said, I had also a few essays here and there, blog posts, etc. But once I decided I'm going to make a book of this, then I began to do what I had done with earlier books, the first three books I ever wrote, and think about how they would go together, what the order might be, what they had in common, etc. And I imagined into being, which is what making art of any kind is the connections. And of course, I also found some, as you have as a reader. You know, I thought, oh, look at this, so look at this. And when I, let's say, I'm just making this up now as an example. Let's say when I got to the fifth story, which of course I was not even thinking of it as, so I had written four and some had been published and one was being considered or whatever. And I thought, oh, I'm going to use that woman that I used in that other story, only she's going to be older here, or she's going to be younger, or she's, you know, one of the things that I personally love about the book is that you can pick a character and see that in one story, she's the main character and maybe even the narrating voice. And in another story, she's one of a group. And in another story, someone just mentions her name, you know, and I just love that, you know, in terms of the linkage, that kind of thing. So it was a lot of fun for me as the writer to think about the relationships and therefore the order. How do I do this given those linkages?
Oh, yeah, I want to ask you about that. But first, I wanted to give a quote that you cite in the beginning of the book. And this is from the writer David Shields, who's a resident of Seattle. I got a chance to interview him. He's extremely honest, candid, very productive, and of course, a brilliant writer. And the quote is there a sense in which a writer's vision gets more thoroughly and beautifully tested in a book of linked stories than it does in a collection of miscellaneous stories or a novel? How do linked story collections combine the capaciousness of novels with the density and intensity of stories? Why do linked stories often have a stronger thematic pull than novels? How does each story in a collection of linked stories achieve closure, but not closure? And I'm not going to ask each of those questions to you individually, but that last one I was most interested in. How does each story in the collection of linked stories achieve closure, but not closure? How would you apply that to Hello, This is Jane?
Well, again, I moved into it. I did not start with that as a goal or even a concept. But as I realized that I was, you know, that I had a collection, I began to think about, okay, so here, this happens, and it's what David Shields calls closure. You know, this, like in the title story, Hello, This is Jane, which is divided into three stories, each of which is divided into at least two. I had to stop my, I thought, get a grip, what are you doing? But I like the form. You know, it's again, it's the kind of thing I was talking about in response to your earlier questions. So anyway, back to David Shields and closure. I saw in the title story opportunities, again, not thinking in advance that I would had this as a goal, but I thought, okay, here's a place where there's a couple women who are dealing with a certain kind of situation, a couple Janes, and then further on, there's a couple Janes who are dealing with a different thing, but by the end of the story, there have been several Janes dealing with those very concerns. And I think of that, I don't know if David Shields would see it this way, but I think of that as a kind of closure. And like I said, I didn't start out writing them that way. I wound up putting the little pieces and then the medium-sized pieces and then the larger pieces together to make that, that the title story. But I see it now in terms of your question, Ken, as being related to what I think he's talking about there with the concept of closure, or a little closure here, a little closure there, moving toward. And of course, this book ends in the future. And in a way, you could say that considerations of the future gives a kind of closure to people who are living in the present, if we dare to be hopeful. This is a rough time for that, but you have to be daring.
Now, how did you sequence the stories? Were they all written before you collected them into the book, or were some written to fit into the book?
I like that question because I have a great answer. You know, why would I like a question otherwise? All but the first one. And the first one was written in response to something I heard someone else say, a person I don't even know, a film producer, Christine Vachon, who is in my thank yous at the acknowledgments because I'm so grateful to her for saying this. She doesn't know me. She had no idea I was in her audience. Anyway, someone in the audience asked her this question, very close to this, not these exact words probably. What are you looking for when you consider, this is an audience filled with film students, by the way, including, and also people like me, whatever that means. So one of the film students said, what are you looking for when you're considering a script for production? And she said several things, but one of them was, I want a story that's heartbreaking. And it was like I had been speared, you know, like right in the middle of my sternum, you know, like what I call the spine of the front of the body, you know, these bones in the upper chest. Wham! I thought, heartbreaking. Whoa! What a concept. Why would someone, you know, and then it was like, you know, again, you know, you go into not necessarily a romantic reverie, but you go into another place in your mind. And I thought, man, there is nothing anymore. There may be many things but nothing any more heartbreaking than the situations of a lot of the women and girls that I came to know and work with who came through the service. And then and this is one of the shortest stories in the book.
And it's titled Answering the Question.
It's titled Answering the Question. And of course, there's a question asked in the story, but then there's this, you know, background question, which I'm answering you with. And that's how that happened. And I made it the first one in the book because I felt that it was so central. Now, of course, then you think, well, then why did you put it in the center of the book? But it's central to, in the way of introduction, what it is I think that it has inside of it. I should reread it before I say stuff like this, but I think that it has inside of it lots of what else is in the book in the longer stories. So anyway, so that's the answer to your question. That one was definitely the last one written. And then, of course, there's only one, which is the longest one.
I wanted to talk about that.
It has never been published anywhere else. Everything else in here has appeared somewhere. But that one, like I say, it's the biggest one. It actually could have been published on its own if it had been. But
oh, yes, yeah. It's novella length. And I told you previously that it's my favorite story in the book. I said perhaps my favorite, but I think it is for now. But we talk quite a bit about the abortion rights and the Janes and how that's a big theme in the book. But you also weave tattooing. In
yes.
there, you know, leading into talking about this story, Sons and Lovers, both as art form and personal expression. And at the end of the book, you have a section called Another Note to Readers. It's not a story, it's a note. And
yes.
There's a quote from there. While I was writing about abortion, I was also writing about tattooing. I'm almost always working on at least two projects, and they often cross-pollinate, sort of move into each other. What do you see as the connection between tattooing and abortion rights? What kind of led to that cross-pollination?
Well, I know the answer to this question, and one of the things that matters in the answer is that I am an old person, because it's no longer true that tattooing is considered the way it was considered in the earlier part of the 20th century, and even in the middle of the 20th century, and especially for women. The idea that a decent woman would be tattooed was anathema. Only bad women got tattooed, or the tattooed lady at a carnival or the circus. And so being tattooed in the years that I was coming up was minimally unusual and maximally not okay. And so there's that in relation to abortion. And also it's about what you decide to do with your physical self. I am my body. My body is me. I should be able, you've all heard it, you know, 1,000,000 times, my body, my choice, I make decisions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a way of claiming ownership over your own body.
Yes, yes. And I loved when I first started to learn about tattooing, which was in the same period, actually, that I was learning about abortion, some overlap anyway. I love the idea of decorating ourselves. And I don't mean that like, oh, everybody should do it. I don't think I'm not into that. I'm not campaigning for it. But I personally love the idea of choosing art that I want to be on my body. You know, I want the sign. And that's, of course, why the cover of the book has this wonderful tattoo by Oregon tattoo artist Don Deaton, who owns the oldest tattoo shop in Oregon, Sea Tramp, here in Portland. He gave me this to you.
Now, you got your first tattoo just a few weeks after the Roe v. Wade decision, right?
I did.
But it wasn't the one on the cover here with the Rose and the Jane?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it wasn't.
What was that first tattoo?
It was, and it still is, a dolphin leaping across my left shoulder. I had been spending time sort of lurking at a tattoo shop in Chicago, where I then lived, having been fired from the Niles Township region, as well as the school itself. And those guys were really good. They were not unfriendly. Later, I discovered that the guy who had been my first tattoo artist was a big deal, Cliff Raven. He's no longer alive, unfortunately, but he was a great artist, and he was an interesting guy. And he had, as all shops do, he was the owner, the flash all around the walls. Everybody who had a chair there put up their designs and had a book of other stuff. And so I cruised all of the stuff, and I have long been someone who identified with and appreciated the dolphin, not the fish, the other kind. And that was my first choice.
And that's the setting of the story that I love so much, Sons and Lovers. It actually starts in a tattoo parlor, and you make a very direct connection in here between tattooing and abortion rights, because the owner of the tattoo parlor, Dwayne, takes up with a divorced mother, Norma, who he gets pregnant, and then she has to decide. She calls the Janes to get counseling about getting an abortion. She already has a daughter, and which she has custody of, and her husband has custody over two young sons. So she doesn't want another. So you've got that connection in there. The mix of the fictional and the actual events is done so beautifully. You even talk about fictionally the Abortion 7 arrest, which occurred again in May 1972. Can you talk about the story, maybe the origin and the inspiration for it?
For the novella itself?
Yes, for Sons and Lovers.
Yeah. Well, some of it, actually, all of my waxing rhapsodic about
the tattoo shops. Yeah.
And the shops. I was just taken with them. I appreciated them. I admired them. I was grateful for them. I thought they were very cool. I started reading articles about tattooing and where it came from, what parts of the world, where it's okay, and so on and so forth. And I suspect, well, I don't know really. I don't want to go in that direction. It's kind of silly, but you know, I was lucky that the first tattoo shop that was literally in my neighborhood was a cool place, you know, and that they didn't treat women badly and that they didn't be stupid about anything, you know, which you can certainly imagine at any, not just a tattoo shop, but, you know, it could have been a hot dog stand. But these guys were very appealing.
I just want to tell readers that it's exceptional. It's such a great story. I think Grace Paley would be very proud of you. I mean, I got some Grace Paley vibes from it. It was just
really? Well, that's an honor. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, she was one of the best. I did want to ask before we go about coming out with a book during the pandemic. The pub date of Hello, This Is Jane is May 3rd, 2020. You chose that date because that was the arrest. The seven Janes were arrested on that date. Your mugshot was taken the next day on May 4th. I read that you did actually talk with the publisher, Left Fork Press, about delaying publication, but you decided to bring it out anyway. Why did you do that? Just because you felt it was something that during this time, not just the pandemic, but when abortion rights are threatened again, that it was kind of the right time to bring out the book?
I think so, yes. Both the publisher, Ryan Forsyth at Left Fork, and I were of multiple minds about the situation. We knew that it would not be ideal or even necessarily okay, but we thought really pretty much what you just said, Ken, that it's so big now. And although we couldn't have understood this when we were making the decision, which was before everything, and I'm not even talking about the rising of consciousness about national racism. I'm just talking about the pandemic, the disease itself. We thought a lot about the difficulties, which you are obviously alluding to, and then the fact that the pandemic was going to make what is already a terrible situation for people with uteruses in the United States of America much worse. And sure enough, not only did the stats, the statistics on domestic violence spike enormously as soon as people were trapped in their homes. As soon as I heard that we had to stay in, I thought, oh, so many more women are going to be beaten. And sure enough, I mean, that's not like I'm a genius. That's how it works. And the second thing was, whoa, there's going to be a lot of sex without contraception, which will be very difficult to get, as will abortion health care, even in places like Oregon, where it's legal and there are clinics, because getting there, you know, all the troubles that some people can hardly get to the grocery store. And sure enough, the figures are rising.
And given the current political situation with the makeup of the Supreme Court, yes, the Republicans, instead of trying to widen their base, are playing to the basest of the base. I think the vast majority of Americans support legal abortions and abortion rights. So you could see it getting demonized again, just I think basically to garner votes rather than...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. From the people they think they can count on. I'm hoping they're wrong about that. Yeah, no question.
And I want to talk about some of the things you're doing to promote the book. So we talked a little bit about the email letters you sent out. You also made so far two tiny movies, is what you call them, and they're available on YouTube. And we'll give your website, too, at the end so people can access all that. But one thing that really interests me, because it mirrors one of the stories in the book, is you've got an event coming up, which will be over by the time this airs. It's a live stream conversation on abortion rights with Kutsiya Sharif, hosted by Chicago's Pilsen Community Bookstore. Kutsiya is kind of that multicultural, different sexual, very diverse abortion rights activist. She's Black, queer, anti-capitalist feminist, is how she describes herself. All of this, you was in your story, Keisha and Joni and Jane. So yeah. I thought it was so ironic that kind of fiction becomes reality.
We've never met in human form, but I was introduced online to her by the folks who are putting this event together. And then I found this wonderful, wonderful essay letter that she wrote last year. She went to the University of Chicago and she wrote it to the campus newspaper about political action and consciousness and the lack thereof in the strength that was needed, and then talked about an event that made that change and questioned people's behavior. And I thought, oh, this young woman is so smart, so together. And of course, we are a kind of what I'd like to think of as classic, but let's just say notable pairing. You know, she's decades younger than I am. She's a woman of color. She identifies as queer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And most important, she has a fabulous smile and she's really smart. So yeah, I feel very lucky to be able to work with her.
Yeah, I'm hoping, again, it will take place the 19th and this will air the 23rd. I'm just hoping there's some way of listeners and readers to get a hold of
the archive
video. Yeah, after it comes. Well, Judith, again, thank you so much for talking with me today. And it's always a pleasure, both on and off the radio.
It is a treat. I so much appreciate what you do on this show. And, you know, speaking as, like I said, a word woman, a book person. Great. Thanks a lot, Ken.
We've been talking with Judith Arcana, author of the new story collection, Hello, This is Jane, published by Oregon's Left Fork Press. You can find out more about the new book online at juditharcana.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Judith for visiting us at KABU and to all of you for listening.